A good day wherever you may be. Welcome to Observations. We're here with Scott and Kirk. I'm Craig. Fellas, there was an onslaught of emails that came my way over these past couple of weeks. Saying, you know, I always hated the Clintons, but now that we know that they are pedophiles and that they're taking trips to Slave Island and engaged in satanic rituals where little children are murdered, and that they that this is all happening out of a pizzeria in what's now called Pizzagate. I mean, where's a sense of judgment among people that they can't figure out that, okay, these guys are all scumbags, but isn't that pushing credulity to an extreme that just isn't even the least bit rational?
You know, if you don't have the facts, why would you present a story like that?
Well, the alt-right is... No. The alt-right is just as crazy as they can be. They're, I mean, many of them are just crazy as loons. You know, the I'll give you an example. I shared in this program several months ago that the most read stories on Hillary Clinton's alleged abuses were actually written by children in Macedonia, and that that what they did is that they essentially took and created really nasty headlines and then edited stories written in other places to suit their agenda for the purpose of click-through news stories. So if you, so it's clickbait. So that, you know, effective, even if you read a mainstream, you know, story online, at the bottom of there's going to have four or five articles that have paid for a position for clickbait because they're going to run ads on that site. And these stories were all made up. All the popular ones were all made up in Macedonia by teenagers that didn't know Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump from Adam, and they were getting hundreds of thousands and sometimes millions of views. So you know, there really is an issue with credibility in terms of stories online.
There's a credibility across the board, though, on this. You have another story that has turned out to be, well, look at the Ohio State shooting, shooting. It was reported as a shooting for the first hour and a half, and it was a guy with a knife in a car. Another time where...
There was one shot fired. Was shot fired by a cop.
Yes, the cops. Yeah, the guy.
You're right.
But you also have stuff to, you know, if we're talking about fake news, the story that came out about hands up, don't shoot, that wasn't true.
Mm-mm.
That wasn't true
no,
at all.
No. In fact, the whole movement on Black Lives Matter is based on a lie. That this idea, in fact, I read an article about it a couple of days ago. Somebody it was the cop and the Joe McKnight case down in Louisiana. I don't know if you guys followed that story, but Joe McKnight and a white guy, Glasher, were Joe McKnight was a star running back for the University of Spoiled Children, USC, Southern Cal, and then he went on to play for the Jets and then got injured. Joe McKnight got involved in a road rage incident and was killed by a man with a handgun, Glasher, who had a history of road rage incidents. And when the sheriff didn't initially indict the shooter, and let him go after about 10 hours of questioning. The NAACP and the Black Lives Matter people had a conniption fit because it was a white person shooting a black man. Joe McKnight was a running back in the NFL. There's not many white running backs. He's black. Hell of a nice guy, but certainly lost his cool on this occasion. Anyway, the 2 days later, after a whole bunch of interviews, they arrest him and charge him with manslaughter, and he says, you know, I don't appreciate this the sheriff said, I don't appreciate people equating this with a racist incident. He says, we have hundreds of witnesses. There wasn't one racial epithet that was thrown out. There is absolutely no issue of race here. And that this notion that Black Lives Matter is so fixated on whites killing blacks is utterly wrong, because almost all murders of blacks are perpetrated by fellow blacks. And so the head of Black Lives Matter and the NAACP both held a press conference and said, so what you're saying is that since it's not as big an issue, it gives whites a license to kill blacks. And you just go, listen, fake news is a real problem. And it's a real problem for us for two reasons. And it's a serious problem for us as part of the covenant for two reasons. One is, because as covenant members, we have all rejected government and politics and religion, we're always looking for news that's outside of the mainstream, because the mainstream reports that which is in favor of what we're opposed to. So we have a natural inclination to seek other news sources. And you know, I've done enough in my life to know that you can't trust most of what the mainstream media writes. No. So they've been writing fake news under the guise of political correctness for a very long time. But since the what they're calling fake news is literally pulled out of the ether, you know, it has a shred of credibility in that, for example, in the Pizzagate story, it is likely that Bill Clinton is a pedophile. The evidence is overwhelmingly supportive of the idea that Bill Clinton's a pedophile. We know this because there's an airplane that that he has flown on. I think he's been on it some 20 times, just shy of 20 times, that is a flying brothel, except the prostitutes on it are underage girls. And the gentleman that owned the airplane, I use gentleman in air quotes, he spent a year and a half courtesy of the federal government because he admitted to having sex on some 20 different occasions with some 20 different underage children. And Bill Clinton regularly flew among the on that airplane. It's a 737 called the Lolita Express. There is no justification for him spending that time in the air with a known pedophile if he's not engaged in pedophilia. By the way, they asked him, the owner of the aircraft, and you know, these people don't interest me enough for me to know his name, but he's a fairly well-known guy. They asked him since Donald Trump has spoken very highly of him, they asked him if he has ever been with Donald Trump with underage girls, and he pleaded the fifth. So there is a shred of truth to this accusation that Bill Clinton is involved in perverted sex. I mean, clearly he sexually abused two women when he was the governor of Arkansas, and he took advantage of a 20-year-old intern in the Oval Office and then lied about it. And Hillary Clinton is on record of defending him on his sexual perversions. But to extrapolate that and say that a pizzeria was being used as a child pedophile ring, and that children were being flown to Sex Island for satanic rituals and murder. I mean,
and the whole thing was designed around how you order your pizza.
Yeah, pizza was a code word for pedophilia. According to this, and it was just a couple of idiots in the blogosphere for the alt-right that came up with this. They're these two guys, as I understand it, are two of the biggest advocates of the fake news that's associated with what's what they call political actors, where there are a number of, I mean, probably as many as 1% of the population who are so misguided by conspiracies. They believe that Sandy Hook, you know, the mass shooting there with the young boy that was on and off mind-altering drugs, and the Boston Marathon bombing, which was a couple of Muslim fundamentalists, that they didn't really occur, that they were all staged, and that all of the people there were actors. And it's those guys that started to promote this, but I must have received a dozen letters from people saying, you know, I always knew the Clintons were scumbag, but this satanic sex slavery for little boys and girls is just too much to bear. And you're going, come on. You know, so
well,
so me.
I mean, someone saying you can poke fun at, you really don't need to go looking for it.
That was my response to them. I said, "Listen, if you want to expose and condemn Bill and Hillary Clinton, it's easy.
Tons of material.
Tons of material. They are absolute scumbags.
Scumbags.
You don't get worse than the two of them. And it's amazing that one was elected president and the other won the majority of the popular vote, which tells you that they're not very smart people that are voting in this country. But plenty of information without going to killing little children and satanically inspired rituals and pizzerias serving as the place where children are picked up and sent off to Slave Island. And the two reasons that bothers me is that there's less than 1,000 people on the planet that are members of the Covenant. And there are maybe 100 to 200 who are willing to speak out on behalf of Yahweh, the Torah, and the Covenant. And should any of us intermix this kind of fake news conspiracy story with our testimony, it negates much of what we have to say.
Well, you warned us a long time ago about conspiracy theory, what Yahweh had to say about it. There are people who conspire to do a lot of things, but we don't need that.
We don't need it.
And we certainly don't need to make everything a conspiracy theory. That's correct.
We don't need it.
Guys. I'm in total agreement on that. And the worry there is who's going to determine what fake news is? Because it's apparently at this point that they won't. People can't hold themselves accountable. Usually I read a story and I the Pizzagate thing. You put one, you do the same thing you just did.
Doesn't pass the smell test.
Okay.
So Bill probably is a pedophile based upon the Lolita Express experiences, but come on, this is really stretching it.
So what they're going to do is they're going to make rules, and there's going to be somebody determining what's real and what's fake. And what you just said is the scary part for me. What happens if this right here, what we're recording right now, gets lumped in with fake news?
Right. Yeah. That's the other issue is that because what we're saying is so politically incorrect. You know, we tell the truth about Christianity and Islam and Judaism and American patriotism and politics. And because we're actually a lone voice out there telling the truth, we're going to be cast in with the fake news crowd, even though all of our evidence is derived from the creator of the universe.
And easily to ascertain.
Yeah, easy to ascertain, easy
like
to...
Like
easy.
Somewhere where you can't find the research. Here's the research. You say,
but the reason that fake news prevails is no one's willing to do the research.
Now, why is it that I've always been against censorship, but I also have always been a big believer in slander and libel laws.
Yeah.
Why can't we have slander and libel laws?
Because as a public figure... You essentially have, like the Clintons, although they spoke out against this, And Scott, as you know, GCN figured large in it because the news is claiming that the primary advocate for this story, the promoter of the story, didn't originate it, but the promoter of the story was Alex Jones, the lead voice of GCN. The Clintons aren't, well, because, first of all, the bill has been on the Lolita Express too many times to be able to, you know, to, because as a public figure, you have to say that it would be impossible for a reasonable person to make this kind of a of an extrapolation from that which is known. And so they're not in a position where they could challenge it, but as a public figure, you just essentially have no rights in the libel and slander area. You know, for example, when Trump sues, and he'll sue anybody that says anything critical of him. He's not in a position to win. He just has deeper pockets, and being sued is expensive. So you have to defend yourself. It's expensive to defend yourself, and so most people will capitulate, even though he can't prevail in the courts with slander laws and libel laws. Just the expense of going up against him is more than most people want to bear.
Yeah, but your name should be worth something.
But you can't.
If you're really being honest and they're lying about you, then boy, you want to stand up and fight that.
Yeah, I know. I know that is the general feeling. You know, I had a 17-page article in Business Week where I was on the cover, and even the cover picture was faked. There were over 100 lies in those outright lies in those pages. And, you know, I contacted attorney after attorney. I could say that, listen, there is nothing in here that is true. It's all a pile of lies, and I can prove every one is untrue. And they said, yeah, you don't have a case. Yeah, you're right. Everything they said was untrue. Yes, they should have known better. Yeah, there's no excuse for that kind of lousy journalism. But as a public figure, and you were a public figure relative to this story, you have no rights. So
yeah, but you would think somebody in the press would say, okay, this is an injustice. I'm going to print the other side of the story.
No.
That doesn't exist.
No. The only example of that exists today, and there is one example of it, and that is that there are a number of lawyers, because law schools have changed a lot. Law schools used to be very competitive, and law schools are not competitive anymore. They work far more on a cooperation basis, and there's a number of law schools that actually make pro bono work a requirement of graduation. And so there's a lot of lawyers coming out now that are devoted to public service. And one of the most interesting is that there's the realization that our Justice Department hasn't been just for a very long time, if ever, and that they have routinely manufactured evidence against innocent people. And that there have been countless people who have been convicted to long jail terms, prison terms, and even to death, where the evidence against them was fabricated by the Justice Department. And so they're one example I know that they're using the media to convey these stories so that the Justice Department has no choice but to review them. But there are thousands of cases around the country that they've had overturned based upon their saying, well, this is the other side of that story. This is what you didn't know that makes the conviction of said individual wrong. So it does exist, but that's about the only place I know where it exists currently.
Yeah, and that's been pretty well documented, too. So that's actually...
Yeah, you know, we're taking the other side of the story against religion, against conservative and liberal politics, against militarism and patriotism. Yeah, how many mainstream periodicals do you find taking up this story? You know,
how many radios would take your show?
Oh, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Not many. And then, the answer is not many. And I occasionally watch the History Channel. You know, my television is mainly for sports. sports. That's kind of my one outlet just to get away from it all. But in the History Channel, I mean, they've got programs, must have, you know, five programs promoting aliens. I'm here to tell you, there has never been a UFO here from outer space. There are no aliens that have visited. That doesn't mean there's not life on other planets. It just means that no one from another planet has ever been here. It's impossible. And yet they have all those shows. And then they've got shows, one that's called the Alaskan Bush People, where I think the collective IQ of the entire family is single digit. I mean, it's just, and you think of, now, wouldn't it be interesting to present the history of Yahweh's testimony, future, past, present, and future history of what God says, and how contrary it is to the misconceptions of 99.999% of Americans, and how brilliant it is, and what he has laid out. For example, the everything about the Syrian war, everything about Noah's Ark, everything about the creation. You this story, you could do absolutely riveting programs. Mm-hmm. On these things that would be, you know, vastly more enlightening and entertaining than anything that they do on those shows, on those channels. And but you think you think anybody's interested in doing that, showing the other side?
They buy prophecy books by the thousands, but they're primarily because they're written to support their Christian belief.
Oh, yeah. And, like, for example, I got another letter today. I must get one a month now from somebody who stumbled into these books. And before they read them, they want to first convince me or find out whether or not I'm in agreement that the Earth is flat.
Really?
Yeah.
Evidence and reason, people. That's...
Oh, okay.
And I just...
Your emails are more interesting than mine. Okay.
And you try so hard. Just listen, if you're of the belief that the Earth is flat and not a sphere like every other planetary body, if that is your conclusion based upon the evidence, then why don't you just save us both a lot of time? And don't write me anymore. Don't bother to read the books. They're not going to do you any good.
No.
You know?
Okay.
You know, if you want fake news, you know, listen to anything that the Pope has to say. You want fake news, listen to an Obama speech.
Yeah. What did he say? He addressed the military in his last address, and he told them they have a right to disregard Trump or question his command and stuff. I mean, he never said that when he was in command. I mean, that's you know, if there's anybody who's allowed in the country to question the command of the leadership,
you have to send me that link, because that doesn't seem...
Yeah, I heard it on the news, but I probably can find it. Maybe Terry can help me find that. Yeah,
because that's pressing. That exceeds my normal smell test. Yeah. That he would actually say something like that, because they're
I believe the quote was, it was their duty to question whatever the command or whatever. I'll have to get it the exact, but it was of that order without question. You know, it was bizarre. Are you kidding me?
If a sergeant tells a private to run up that hill, and the private says, you know, it's my duty to question your order. Or a lieutenant tells the sergeant to march the troops around there to the right, and the sergeant says, it's my duty to question your order. I can tell you where that private and sergeant are going to end up. Now, personally, I'm not going to be part of the military, because I don't respond well to orders.
No.
And you give me an ultimatum, and you've lost. I don't care if you're saying, you know, I'm going to give you $1 billion or a kick in the butt. If you give me an ultimatum, You do not have my attention. I'm going to reject anything you have to say as an ultimatum.
I think I found the here it is.
Okay.
Give me one second here.
Nation that believes freedom can never be taken for granted, and that each of us has a responsibility to sustain it. The universal right to speak your mind and to protest against authority. To live in a society that's open and free, that can criticize a president without retribution.
There.
Well, now the context, he's talking to the military.
That's hugely different than what you said. What he said is correct. If you're in the military, you have the right to be opposed to a political leader. You have that right. You don't lose the right to be able to opt out of elections or favor one candidate or another, or be opposed to one candidate or another because you join the military. You don't lose your citizenship by being part of the U.S. military. So in America, we have the right, to criticize our government. It's there's the old joke that Khrushchev once said. We have something in common. He said, in America, you can criticize Nixon, and here in Russia, we can criticize Nixon. But that's just another example of people taking things in the context that it was given in. It was not the right thing for him to say.
Well, I didn't hear this thing, but I heard what the guy said about it. But I think it's a good case in point. These guys, and you go, got it.
There's not much that Obama says that I would agree with, and I certainly do not even agree with his statement there, particularly in that context. There's no reason for him to make that statement in that context. Nonetheless, he did not say what is reported of him.
But I reported so.
There's another story. We're talking about child abuse. A friend sent me a story out of the UK. And this story out of the UK shows that there are 83 suspects involving almost an equal number of teams, like 60 some odd teams, football, soccer, in the UK, that have been involved with child sex abuse. So 83 players and some 60 teams involving 639 affidavits. So the 639 affidavits accusing 83 soccer players, professional soccer players. This says 83 potential suspects and 98 teams. I don't know how that math works, but nonetheless, that's what they say. Now, the victims. Of the victims identified so far, 98% are male, and their ages range from 7 to 20.
My God.
Oh, my God. I mean, listen, for men who are entitled and are getting paid ridiculous amounts of money to play a game, and being worshipped, and people's sports now almost
stars,
almost religion. You would say, all right, that's the mentality that you're going to get, what you see in the NFL of big men with too much testosterone abusing women. But to have this many players involved and the victims being little boys.
Well, that's getting sick.
That, I mean, whoa, this is sick.
You know, I'm getting where I just can't stand this old world. I'm glad it's coming out the way it's coming out. I just, when I was sick, I said, well, this be good. I'll just go play golf with Richard. It's horrible to keep hearing this stuff.
It is. It's
all those stories you did about the Catholic Church and the just.
One of the things that was interesting, of course, I've mentioned this several times, is that when you read Yah's testimony and Daniel, it becomes obvious that he views the source of human institutionalized religious, political, militaristic, and economic corruption having originated in Babel, which is Babylon. It's the basis of the English word Bible. And that it simply evolved from there throughout the world, and that there were five principal beasts, as and Yahweh looks at these large civilizations, these governments, as beasts, as vicious beasts, and that there were five iterations of it of particular interest. And of course, it was Babylon to Persia, and Persia to the realm of Alexander of Macedon, Alexander the Great, Greece, to Rome, which he said was just astonishingly more vicious than was any of these others. And of course, I ended up writing two chapters that were almost a book in length on how just perverted and vicious Rome was. And now Yah is writing this down 500 years before Rome would even exist. Then he goes on to say that out of that would come the worst
beast of all.
And that it would be promoted by a lowly and little horn, Paul, and that this beast would be would trample upon the whole world. But there's only one institution that's grown out of the Imperial Rome, and that's the Roman Catholic Church, and it is the only worldwide beast. And so when I was doing all those shows on the perversion of Imperial Rome and Roman Catholicism, it's obvious who God hates the most. And, we did this program a week ago, and the one in the Friday evening, specifically on God in Revelation affirming that it's the city on seven hills. As a matter of fact, it was referenced here in Yeshayah in the second chapter, and then we dug into it in Revelation, where, you know, God speaks of the demonic plague that emanates particularly in the last days, from the city on seven hills. Well, the only worldwide institution in Rome is the Roman Catholic Church.
You can't hide from it. I mean, he's telling you exactly what it is. I mean, it's no question.
No, so as my sons would tell me when I was criticizing Imperial Rome for being the most vicious civilization in human history, they said, be careful. You know, what about Sparta? What about Carthage? You know, what about the Aztecs? What about the Incas? You know, what about the Druids? Yeah, what about the Germanic peoples?
Yeah.
And it just went on and on and on and on and on and on and on. Look how ruthless the dynasties were in China, but particularly during the time they were building the wall, and you know, it didn't care how many hundreds of thousands of people died. I mean, how would you find a more ruthless regime than the Mongols? Or after them, the Turks. His comment was, okay, you're right. They're despicable. But why would you view America as any less despicable? We kill more people than they do.
Yeah. Well, we can name three or four incidents that wiped out hundreds of millions of people.
Oh, you know, you look at this like this, the most recent attack on Mosul in Iraq. And I don't know if you've been following this, but it's been going on now for 2 months. They've been trying to take Mosul back from the Islamic State. And, you know, my view was initially when I heard that was their plan was to say there is no outcome on this other than to go from bad to worse. Listen, I recognize that the Islamic State as a fundamentalist Islamic group is extraordinarily hurtful and hateful, and that they have kidnapped all of the non-Muslim girls and turned them into sex slaves, and that they that any Shiite Muslim that doesn't kowtow to them, they've killed, and that Christian men they have crucified, literally crucified. And that you know they are as ruthless and barbaric as any people could possibly be. But that by attacking Mosul, what you're going to find is that all you end up with is hundreds of thousands of innocent people dying. And enormous amounts of weapons squandered. And that that ultimately it's going to be a heap of ruins that will be controlled by a Shia military that will treat the Sunni there as badly as the Islamic State has treated the Christians and Shia. And so you can't make a better situation. And in the process, there'll be a 500,000 refugees that will flood into Europe and bring their anti-Semitism and jihadist mentality with them.
Yes.
And so it's a really stupid idea to invade. Now, this is the part that is interesting about the story. All of the military experts, including even the Iraqis that America trained, wanted to put a horseshoe around Mosul, recognizing it's the second largest city in Iraq, and you had to have a way for the Islamic State fighters to escape because they're suicide fighters. They're going to kill just an inordinate number of your people and innocent civilians if you trap them. And number two, you have to have a way for the civilians to be able to escape. So they wanted to surround Mosul with a horseshoe. You know, a horseshoe is open on one end.
Right.
So it's three sides closed, one end open. Let them retreat. Yeah, out of there to get the civilians out, to get the suicide jihadist out. And just capture the city again. And then let people back in on a controlled basis.
Did you not identify who's who yet?
No. That's not what's happening. No, they see the government of Iran, which I've said for a long time, we gave Iraq to Iran.
Right.
The Iranians, the clerics in Iran said, hell no, you're not doing that. Encircle it. Kill every one of them. Make it a killing field. Kill all of them. Encircle it. Don't allow anyone to escape. Kill them. And so there was an interview with the American general that is providing intelligence and bombing runs and all that sort of thing. He says, well, you know, the Iraqis know far more about how to deal with this insurgency than we do. They've been dealing with it now for a long time, and we're just going to acquiesce to their judgment in this regard.
What a noble thing to say.
Oh, my God. Are their lives worth saving? Probably not. I mean, the sense of the poor people there are so savagely indoctrinated with religion. There is no hope for the region. But it's one thing
call,
for them.
Though,
yeah, it's, well, yeah, it's, well, yeah, it's
gave you permission from Yahweh.
Right, right.
Everybody.
You know, if a Muslim's going to kill another Muslim, or if a Muslim's going to kill a Christian, I don't. Shame on them. But it's not our fight. We shouldn't be aiding and abetting mass murder.
Well, you're not supposed to. It doesn't say that you can't kill. It says you're not supposed to make a habit out of it. And if
right.
you encircle somebody and then you go about the systematic destruction of them, that sounds like you're making a habit out of something.
Now, that'd be a valid point. In fact, if you have the largest military in the world, and your military and your spy apparatus collectively are larger than the rest of the world's combined, And over the first 400 years that since the first Caucasians from Europe invaded North America, you have fought 101 wars, one every 4 years. Methinks you're making a habit of it.
Yeah.
I can't argue, no. And I don't disagree. So,
this is the reason why in Yeshaya 2:15, which is where we are picking up from last week, God was continuing to go against the things that he's supposed to. And this, for those who would sing, God bless America, shame on you. He says, and I will be against every official, high and exalted podium and pulpit, and against every fortified and impregnable barrier and wall. Maybe Donald Trump didn't read that passage when he wanted to build his wall between the United States and Mexico. I will be against every fortified and impregnable wall. I will be against every podium and pulpit. Wow. That's when people get up and share their own religious and political and militaristic opinions. You know that Trump, I think, now already has three generals that are part of his inner circle.
I heard that. You know, he just seems to like generals.
Whoa.
He likes military.
You're going to make a... yeah, maybe we need... That's his solution, more military. I'm going to be against him. So God is not working with your... You know, you pray for your leaders. What a waste of breath.
Yeah.
God is opposed to them. Now, it's interesting here, this word for I'm against every exalted podium and pulpit. Probably no more exalted podium and pulpit than either the popes in the Vatican or the President of the United States in the White House. It's from Migdal, which is a derived from Magog. And so it's... you know, you're caused here just to pause for a moment and say, all right, I'm against Gog and the region of Magog. And, you know, this is what when in Ezekiel, God describes it this way. It says, son of man, direct your presence against Gog of the land of Magog, the leader of Meshuch and Tubal, and prophecy concerning him. Say, thus says Yahweh, behold, I am against you, God, the ruler of Meshuch and Tubal, Persia, Cush, Put will be with you. Also, Gomer with its troops, and Beth Togarmah from the far north with all of its troops, and many Gentile nations will be with you. I decided I would just do a quick, because it's a, I'm sure it's a subtle reference here too. It's not a subtle reference in Ezekiel 38, that's right in your face, but it was a subtle reference in Yeshaya 2:15. I just don't like to let anything that's a reference, Migdal, just go unnoticed.
I don't think it's that subtle. I mean,
okay, it wasn't. You're right. It's not that subtle. But
pretty right in your face.
Yeah, just for
who these
for
people are and who
yeah. But you do have to do some homework to know who these people are, because Meshuch and Tubal doesn't mean anything to anybody today. But Meshuch and Tubal tribes, the Meshuch tribe. There was a, you know, this is not rocket scientists here. There was actually a Meshuch tribe. There was a Tubal tribe. They coalesced around 500 BCE, which would, you know, this is a 700s. This only, so they were independent tribes until 200 years after this prophecy when they coalesced. They were, they formed the Georgian kingdoms. Now, that's not like down there in Georgia, y'all, no, and Atlanta. This is the Russian, Turkish, Caspian Sea, Caucasus region, Georgia, the Georgian Republic. And it's it says that the region would include all of, if you look at the region where these tribes were back in the day, would include most all of present-day Turkey, which, of course, is a growing menace to Israel, Syria, including the areas under the control of the Islamic State. And you could also include the Georgian Republic, Armenia, and Azerbaijan, in addition to portions of northwestern Iran and Iraq. The Georgian Republic is particularly interesting because before the fusion of the Mishak and Tubal tribes, it was under the dominion of the Hittites. And there's a lot that is said about the Hittites. That gives you a feeling for who he's talking about
there.
Yeah. And he says, and I will be against all of the ships of Tarshish and against over and above all of the vessels coveted treasures. And now, I had to do a major stop here because this is not subtle. This is I am against the ships of Tarshish and against their coveted treasures in their vessels, and I was saying, okay, wait a minute. We are absolutely talking about Yahweh's return. This is the last days where he is saying, I'm against, you know, all forms of government, all forms of religion, their podiums, you name it, their protective barriers. And by the way, you know, the U.S. military would be considered a protective barrier. So he's against all these things, and he says, I'm against the ships of Tarshish.
Yeah.
And I'm saying, okay. Now, Tarshish had to exist, and it had to represent something that exists today. Okay, so I'm extrapolating here, but I think I'm on pretty firm ground because God doesn't make up stories.
I researched what you researched, and absolutely, I mean, Tarshish is... now, the only difference I found was there was a little heavier weight towards where Tarshish was in the Spanish Iberian Peninsula, as opposed to necessarily, but the connection between that and Carthage and the Phoenicians and Tyre were absolutely on the money.
Yeah.
So we know who they are. Historically.
Yeah. Yeah. There's only one association with Tarshish and Spain, and that is that and we're going to go through this because it's important to understand that God says, I am against all of the ships of Tarshish. So you've got it, and what's in their vessels, the coveted treasures in their vessels. So it's important for us to recognize who is Tarshish today. And for us to know that, the answer to that, we have to know who was Tarshish then. Okay. So there's a lot of references to Tarshish. Let's begin with what we know. Yonah, corrupted to Jonah. Yonah, by the way, that is one of the many reasons why I say it's Yahweh. It's Yonah, and it's so and the O sound is from the wa and Yonah. So Yonah sets sail in a small trading ship headed to Tarshish from Jaffa, which is Jaffa. Jaffa is a port on the Mediterranean Sea in central Israel. So if he is if he's headed to Tarshish from the coast of Israel, and he's in a small trading ship. Mm-hmm. Well, what would be the furthest extreme that Tarshish could be?
Well, that'd be Spain, unless you go all the way to England.
Yeah,
well, go
perhaps, but even that would be pushing it, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
So it's in the Mediterranean. The easy answer to the question is that Tarshish absolutely has to be in the Mediterranean, within reach of a trading ship from Jaffa, Jaffa, Israel. So that's a pretty good clue. All right. There is. It's also interesting that there is an Akkadian inscription with a reference to Tarshish. Akkadian was the language of the Babylonians and the Assyrians. To Tarshish in the annals of Assyrian king Esarhaddon, circa 669 BCE. So it was also at least, if not in the sphere of influence, within the sphere of understanding, of knowledge of the Persians. And we know that the Persians interacted with, in a very hostile way, the Greeks, including when the Greeks occupied, they were the naval power surrounding Italy and the islands off Italy.
Right.
Okay. And Babylonians and the Assyrians also engaged with the Carthaginians during that period of time, who were the dominant sea power at that time.
Yeah.
There's also a Phoenician inscription on what's called the Nora Stone, referencing Tarshish as a substantial trading partner. Okay, so the Phoenicians, which were just north of Israel, and what was called Phoenicia at the time, and that culture, though, the Phoenicians didn't just occupy Phoenicia, which would be, you know, a good part of Lebanon today. That wasn't their only, and Alexander the Great pretty much did them in, but they didn't just occupy that. Their culture and language, in fact, their race, formed the Punic Nation. The Carthaginians were Phoenicians.
Mm-hmm.
And so they, and there's also considerable evidence that the civilizations on Crete that were so advanced, Minos, was also Phoenician in origin. So yes. The Phoenicians were a real seafaring powerhouse of their day.
The Mediterranean,
right? Yeah, they did. Well, they had a strong influence over that portion of the Mediterranean. The Mediterranean was really controlled by Carthage. Carthage was the dominant. Carthage was the, when we're giving away some hints here, but Carthage was the U.S. in terms of there wasn't any navy that could even come close to competing against it.
Yeah, until the Romans actually beat them, and they could beat them that way. They had to use a military, but until they beat them, they controlled. Yeah, everything.
Yeah, yeah. And the Romans didn't. And the Romans didn't beat them fair and square. They formed a deal with the Carthaginians, and then they welched on the deal, and they caught the Carthaginians by surprise because the Romans can't be trusted.
Well, yeah.
So I mean, it wasn't a fair fight, if you will. Okay. So this depiction reveals that Tarshish was part of a seafaring nation of merchants, further affirming the prophetic depiction of the place. Now, according to Ezekiel 27 and Isaiah 23, Tarshish is where King Solomon, David's son, in partnership with the King Hiram of Tyre in Phoenicia, acquired great amounts of imported and important metals, including silver, gold, and tin, which was used to make bronze and iron.
Mm-hmm.
So, based upon these insights, and we're told specifically that the metals that Solomon got in from Tarshish were silver, gold, and tin. It's based on this that it becomes obvious.
Yes, it's even mentioned in 1 Kings. Gold,
yes.
Silver.
Yeah,
ivory.
Because the reason that Carthage became so rich was an integrated combination of things. One is that they had the most powerful navy and merchant marine, which went hand in hand. Number two, they had exclusive rights to all of these minerals and all the places where they were the most prevalent, and that's how Spain comes into the picture.
Mm-hmm.
It's where they mined. And number three is they became the reserve currency of the world. So if you wanted to trade, you used the Carthaginian currency, since they were the primary traders of the world. They were the economic engine of the known world at that time, and they had the merchant marine to move everything around at that time, and they had the navy to control what they were doing. But they were the reserve currency. It was their currency that became the catalyst for trade, and their primary trade, the number one thing that they did, is they had a veritable monopoly on silver, gold, and tin. So we're pointing right to Carthage, located near Tunis, Tunisia today. It would be a likely suspect, especially since they were known for their superior fleet of military and trading vessels. This assessment is also supported in the Septuagint. The Israeli trader turned Roman historian Flavius Josephus in the first century CE insisted that Tarshish was Tarsus in Sicilia, today in south central Turkey. That's tantalizing because the spelling is similar to what was the hometown of the individual God opposes most in all of human history. That would be Paul.
Oh,
yeah. And the author of Mystery Babylon, the actual founder of Roman Catholicism, is Paul. But, you know, Josephus was also the one that said Mount Zion had nothing to do with Moriah, was actually the mountain west of far west of the city that overlooked the Mediterranean. So he got a lot wrong, including his own personal judgment. He sided with Rome against Israel. Yeah.
Not a good move.
Not a good move. But also viable, and in association with Carthage and Rome, the Norristone inscription insinuates that Tarshish is Taros, which is a seaport on the island of Sardinia, which is off the Italian coast.
And coast, yeah.
Southwest of Rome. This Taros was founded over 3,000 years ago. It was claimed by the Phoenicians in the 8th century BCE. The time that this was being conveyed, it was a Phoenician port, supporting the prophetic testimony inscribed in Yashaya at this time. Tharos fell under the control of the Carthaginians thereafter, which wasn't much of a change since the Carthaginians were really Phoenicians. Thereafter, and became part of a regional trading network that included what is now Tunisia, Libya, Corsica, Sicily, Malta, and all of Sardinia, and coastal Iberia, Spain, where the Punics mined silver, lead, and tin ore for bronze. At this time, the Punic Navy enabled the Carthaginian merchant ships to trade throughout the entire Mediterranean, up past France and Spain to the British Isles, and south along the west coast of Africa, imposing a complete monopoly throughout this enormous region on trade, and especially on important metals, which is specifically what God says of them, and doing it so through their vessels. I mean, God's testimony, anytime that he says something, you say, well, you know, nobody knows, and you read, you know, most of the religious material, nobody knows where these people are or where they existed, and you do a modicum of study, and it becomes, well, yeah, God got his story right again. I mean, he doesn't get just future history right, prophecy.
His past.
He does what man can't even do. I mean, man, we can't even get the past right. God gets it right. So while Tharos, Sardinia, was assimilated into the Roman Empire following the Punic Wars between 264 and 146 BCE, during the time addressed by the prophets, it was under Punic control, and the Carthaginians were known for a proprietary process using limestone to vastly improve the purity of molten metals, especially iron, serving as yet another affirmation of Yahweh's historical portrait of Tarshish. In fact, not only was Carthage, by the way, an iron, think of weapons, think of war, think of militaries, think of power.
Building the ships together.
Oh, man, yeah. I mean, iron was it, folks.
Yeah,
bronze and iron, man. That was it.
It's
like saying jet fuel today.
Yeah, high technology.
Yeah, that's exactly right. In fact, not only was Carthage founded and built by the Phoenicians, not only was it the world's most acclaimed trading empire, boasting a naval force and merchant fleet that would rival Rome and Greece combined, not only was the Punic culture ruthlessly warlike and aggressively expansionist, their prowess with molten metals and their flourishing international trade made them the first nation to develop and deploy a comprehensive monetary system of coinage. They were also bestial, engaging in child sacrifice, and they were resolutely religious. Ultimately, they carved out a monopoly in precious metal trading, gold and silver, tin, ore for bronze, and iron. And they used their wealth to gild the most garish religious shrines and to fund the world's most powerful navy. they became the wealthiest and most extravagant merchants in ancient times. Further, the name Punic, which applies to all things Carthaginian, is derived from the language of its mother city, none other than Tyre, Phoenicia, once again affirming even the details in Yahweh's prophecy. This Phoenician-Carthaginian alliance, called Tarshish by God, represents a seafaring nation that extended throughout the Mediterranean from Turkey to Spain. It is today the United States.